I'm just gonna. Sorry,
that's okay. Okay. That should do it. Okay. Good.
And let me know if you need anything.
We're on a tight ship here. Whatever clock in the room is indicative.
The iPad has the official time always, right? That's like the new atomic clock, the iPad time.
Oh, really?
I see Peter eating, and I'm looking around the room saying,
Okay, I think we should go ahead and get started. I am very pleased to welcome Sheldon Danziger, who is a distinguished university professor at the Ford School at the University of Michigan, where he both helped create and continues to run the National Poverty Center. Sheldon's first job was at University of Wisconsin, where he also directed for a time the Institute for Research on Poverty, and he got his PhD in economics at MIT. Sheldon has over 15 volumes, either authored or edited, on topics related to poverty. And for those of you who are currently taking my poverty and public policy course, you will recall that Sheldon has been the inspiration for a lot of what we've done in the class this quarter. So you can give him the credit for all the things you like, and you can blame him for all the things you don't like. And I guess without further ado, let's welcome Sheldon.
Thanks. It's great to be here, and it's terrific that two Michigan grads, Ann and Marianne, have brought a federally funded poverty center to Davis. It's terrific to see how much they've accomplished in just 1 year, and a large crowd in the room obviously says they've been either paying you to come or doing something right. I'm going to, I know Peter Lindert is here, so I'm not an economic historian like Peter, but I'm going to spend a little time talking about recent economic history. then talk about some early findings from the Michigan Recession and Recovery Study that we're doing at the National Poverty Center. Talk a little bit about how one might reduce poverty and promote opportunity in the next decade, but my bottom line is actually a very pessimistic one. I gave a talk like this in June of 2009, and I was quite optimistic at the time, and I said it was the best of times and it was the worst of times, and I said it was the worst of times because unemployment was about 10%, and I said it was the best of times because the 2009 stimulus, which had passed in February of 2009, had in it all of the aspects that poverty researchers had been talking about for the previous 15 years, a number of specific policy changes, and I'll talk more about them, to unemployment insurance, the earned income tax credit, Head Start, Pell Grants, etc. And that, you know, the Obama administration was planning to make these things permanent, and that, of course, by 2012, the unemployment rate would be back to 6%, and these policies that were in the stimulus would be permanent, and then we might expect poverty to fall below the levels that we had seen since 1973. We never got below 1973. We got close in 2000, and so I was optimistic then. Now, we're obviously better informed than I was in 2009. The unemployment rate is still 8%. All of these aspects of the stimulus, most of them have expired or will expire, and we're waiting to see how big the cuts are going to be in the programs that I thought would be extended. So I actually think there is no possibility that poverty and inequality are going to decline significantly in the foreseeable future. So, from optimism to pessimism. A lot of people know this, but I know at least a lot of people in economics know this. Hillary and Anne and Marianne have written a lot about this themselves. For a broad audience, I'll go quickly through. And the reason I want to do that is because the post-war on poverty decade really was a golden age of social policy, coming at the end of a quarter century golden age of economic growth. The war on poverty has a very negative perception. Marianne was telling me, I hadn't seen it, that the Wall Street Journal recently had a piece by Gary Becker and Jim Heckman saying the war on poverty failed. Martha Bailey and I have a volume which is under review called The Legacies of the War on Poverty, and we actually think lots of war on poverty programs made remarkable changes, and that poverty would be a lot higher than the high rate today if these programs hadn't been put in place in this decade. But what's in historical retrospect from the current perspective, I guess the soundbite I would say, is as somebody who had a very different view of Richard Nixon in 1974 than I have today, you know, Richard Nixon's social policy was much more liberal than Bill Clinton's social policy, and so in retrospect, the good old days carried through the Nixon presidency. So this post-war on poverty decade really goes from Johnson's declaration of war on poverty in 1964 through Nixon's departure from the White House in August of 1974. And in fact, the reason I remember this so specifically is I started as a postdoc at the Institute for Research on Poverty in September of 74, and every fall is when the poverty numbers are announced, and so the low point is the poverty rate of 1973, which was announced in fall of 74, but is Nixon's last year in office. So this is this remarkable period in which there both is this rising tide that does lift all boats from the period from 47 to 73. There were modest recessions, rapid wage growth for all workers, and I have a little data I'll show after this. The spread of employer-provided health insurance and pensions in this quarter century. Congress is raising the minimum wage relative to inflation. In current dollars, the minimum wage was something like $9.50 in 1973. It's $7.25 today, so the minimum wage has been lower and the poverty rate has been higher for almost every year since 1973, a period of rapidly falling poverty and slowly falling income inequality. And again, people know this. Since then, poverty, which was about 11% in 1973, hit 15% in the early 80s recession, in the early 90s recession, and in this recession. Poverty was falling during recoveries, but never back to the 73 levels. Less educated workers no longer benefit from economic growth. Inequality increases rapidly, and we have an effective safety net only for the elderly, for whom poverty is substantially lower than in 1973, and who, because they have inflation-protected Social Security and SSI and universal health insurance, with Medicare and Medicaid for them, they don't suffer during business cycles the way others do. This is just simple descriptive data which captures this notion of a rising tide lifting all boats on the left. Basically, everybody's real family inflation-adjusted income doubled between 47 and 75. Peter Gottschalk and I, in our book America Unequal, do some fancier computations on this, but simple charts are enough. If anything, the 95th percentile is slightly lower than the other percentiles, but basically a rising tide means all boats, lifts all boats. The bars on the left basically are all around 90%, 90 to 95%, and there, so the level of growth is high and it's evenly distributed. 75 to 2010, a nice little step ladder with those at the bottom gaining relatively little. Those at the top gaining relatively little relative to the growth in this golden age that ended in 73, but nonetheless rising inequality. So when people say, you know, obviously the war on poverty failed because poverty is still high, the, again, a simple census chart, I've done some regression things that are a little more complicated than this, but basically nobody, when Peter and I and Hillary's father were all at IRP in the mid-70s and had been asked what is the median earnings of men going to be 40 years from now, nobody would have said it's going to be the same thing. And that's basically it. So in my, you know, the whole story, why is poverty so high? It's because median earnings of male full-time, full-year workers stopped growing. This is obviously a group. If you work full-time year-round, you don't get unemployment insurance and you don't get welfare, so it's not the negative response to rising government benefits that people would say. And in some sense, this is the remarkable period. I don't know, Peter, is this, were there other previous periods in American history with this long a period of no median wage growth?
That may depend. Well, the 1930s is the closest.
But that was a decade.
No. A decade and a half at the start of the 20th century, but this is pretty outstanding, especially since it's immediately preceded, as you showed me,
just a doubling. Right, right. So this, and in some sense, that's... if you listen to the politicians, the assumption underneath the view that we should never raise tax rates is that a rising tide still lifts all boats. I mean, it just, and it did from 47 to 73. It just hasn't from 73 to 2012. I'll just flip through this. People know this, so that's all men. This is by educational attainment, where the gains are for people with BAs and higher degrees. That's the same data. Household income by quintile. There's one in here. That's the official poverty rate. I'll go through this pretty quickly. But again, one of the things I've said when people talk about, oh, it's terrible under Obama, the poverty rate rose and it's 15%. There was actually a higher increase in poverty during the first Reagan. I couldn't get any reporters to report that I talked to this. When the poverty numbers came out, isn't it terrible after all the stimulus that Obama put in place? Unemployment is still, look how high unemployment is, and poverty is 15%. And I said, well, the recession in the 80s wasn't that severe, and it hit 15%. And if you actually look at the data, it went up more under the first Reagan administration. Again, this is well-known territory to economists. People argue over how much... the various sources have to do with the high rates of poverty, stagnation of male median earnings and rising inequality, skill bias, technological changes, globalization, declining unionization, erosion of the minimum wage, declining progressivity of the income tax, the explosion of executive pay. It's all of the above, and people have their different choices, but the point is there really has been nothing going in the way of reducing inequality except the expansion of food stamps, the expansion of the earned income tax credit, which for historical reasons don't get counted in the official poverty rate, but clearly are progressive policies that have been put in place and have grown over the past years. Again, this is the same thing. If somebody said, well, what about after-tax income? You basically see the same kind of things. So whatever measure you use, you'll see a step ladder moving up. Oh, I know why I have this one, because of the top 1%. So the ones, in other words, even the top 20% haven't done that well relative to the top 1%. But again, and this is after tax, this is the CBO data, and so I think most people think these are the most reliable, carefully done, and I think they've also, I can't remember whether these also adjust for different persons, so it may... So that brings us to the Great Recession, and at the point at which obviously the Great Recession would be expected to raise poverty and inequality. The recession was deep. About 6% of all jobs were lost. Maybe it's the next chart that shows in the 80s only 3% of the jobs were lost, so this was twice as severe. And partly why I say, oh, so poverty. If you had asked me in 2009, I would have thought poverty would have hit 17-18%, not 15% as a peak, because we lost so many jobs. It was accompanied by a labor market crisis, a financial crisis, and a housing market crisis. Yeah, this is This is from the Economic Policy Institute. But so this recession is twice as deep, 94%. We lost 6% of jobs, whereas in 81, we only lost 3%. But the point here is that in 81, the recovery was quick, so that by 24 months from the beginning of the recession, you were back at the same level of jobs. Then in 2000, it was a very shallow recession. We never lost more than 2%, but it took 4 years to get back, and people talked about the 2000s as a jobless recovery. And before the recession, I think Paul Krugman was talking about the 2000s of being a lost decade, because median family income never recovered. When you sort of have the worst of both worlds here, you had a deep loss and then a very slow recovery. Michael Greenstone and Adam Looney at Brookings put out projections, and I believe the last one I saw said that if we begin to create 200,000 jobs a month, which we haven't yet begun to do, but assuming we did, then we would get back the same number of jobs 5 years from now, something like that. So nobody is predicting a very rapid recovery, which is part of the reason why I expect poverty and inequality to stay so high. So that brings me to some new data that I want to talk about that a group of us at the Poverty Center have been working on. And it's sort of, if there's a message from this, it's that the effects of the recession were even broader than one would think based on unemployment, but maybe not in California. And the reason I say this is, again, when I was talking to Marianne and Ann, I was saying about how few of the people in our sample, you'll see that in a minute, weren't affected by the recession. So I said, you know, we give people these calendars and we ask them in every month from January 07, we interviewed people twice. So you sort of get a two-year calendar in 09 and then another two-year calendar in 11. And if you asked me what I was doing every month, I would just take the line from employed and draw it across the 48 months. That's pretty quick to do. Lots of people obviously have to think, let's see, I was laid off in this month, then I got my job back, then I was laid off. And I said, it's remarkable how few people just had that employment across the top. And then I realized that in our data, Davis faculty don't show up in that category because there's also furlough, wage cut, etc. And so all the California faculty are in this group. No unemployment, but still affected. So maybe people in California wouldn't be as surprised when we show the extent of these effects. This study sort of had its intellectual background in a welfare reform panel that a group of us did from 97 to 2003, where we followed a panel of welfare recipients, and sort of our niche was that we, by definition, weren't going to be as big as the PSID or the NLSY or the SIP, but that we had this very broad range of questions. Sort of think of it as the health data sets have great data on health and mental health, but really bad data on jobs and economics. The Federal Reserve Board does a really good job on assets, but they don't get anything on health and mental health. And we would try to get, with this multidisciplinary team, lots of information. So you have the kinds of data we have, and we're just beginning, so we now have panel data, interviews in 2009 and 2011, and these calendars that go from 07 to 11 on the employment side. So we have this broad range, and looking at this broad range, in some ways I was surprised at the extent of the hardships I'll show you. This is not the city of Detroit. It's the three-county Detroit metro area, so it includes the wealthy suburbs as well. In fact, the median income of the sample is relatively high. 41% of all respondents were unemployed in at least 1 month. And again, this is in my optimistic days in the depths of the recession, as lots of people I knew who lost jobs through no fault of their own, I thought, oh, this will lead, like the Depression led to this perception that people who are unemployed aren't lazy, and they weren't laid off because of their own incompetence. So it'll change our perceptions of the unemployed. And I haven't seen that lasting very long either. About 38% were employed in all months. 23% were behind on rent, mortgage, or in foreclosure. 13% had been evicted, homeless, or moved in with others. This is a random sample of people 19 to 64. These are very deep. Now, the recession in Michigan and in Detroit was deeper than it was elsewhere. I think I have it here, but if I don't, as I recall, the unemployment rate in Michigan hit 15% when it was 10% at the peak in the U.S. So not everybody in the country suffered as much, but certainly there were places that were as hard hit. Oh, there it is. So this is... This is our sample. So this is the monthly unemployment rate, and you can see, I was talking to one of your doctoral students today who's interested in young adults. The young adult unemployment rate in January 07 was already higher, but youth disproportionately bore the brunt. The other thing you see is that there is... not surprising, by March 2011, when we were in the field, I think the national unemployment rate was 9% then. For mature adults, which in this sample is 35 to 54, the unemployment rate was still 12%. No, that's mature adults is 55 and older. The prime age rate is 35 to 54. The youth rate still. So there was very little recovery. We're I think we now have the money to go in 2013, and we'll see the extent to which some of these hardships have gone away. These are the residents experience at least 12 months of unemployment, which is our measure of long-term unemployment. I guess the point I would make is even 9% of the people who have a BA had a spell of 12 months of unemployment or more. Obviously, in any data set, you will see large black, non-black differences, large BA, no BA, and large blue-collar, white-collar. But certainly the extent of long-term unemployment was widely distributed. Long-term unemployment is clearly associated with these hardships, but again, I was surprised at the extent of problems. So the blue bars are people who had no unemployment. Now that could be they were not in the labor force, they were retired, they were disabled. This is not the data for people who work in every month. But again, the blue bars are pretty high, 24% food insecurity, this is the standard USDA measure, 20% a housing problem, I'll tell you in a minute what the financial problems are, foregone medical care. It's always the case that the long-term unemployed have more of it, but again, I was struck by how broad the hardships are. The same thing with health and mental health. The red bars are people with no unemployment, but people talk to you that in the survey. These are in-home interviews, and it's a survey of about an hour, but there's also some opportunity for people to say things that get written down by the interviewer. So you get quite a lot of depression, anxiety, and fair or poor health in the no unemployment group, although again, these are much higher for people who've been long-term unemployed. This is hard to see, but this is so the Davis faculty are here, any employment problem, but no unemployment, because employment problems include layoff, wage reductions, and furloughs. And again, you can see no employment problems since January 07. This is only 26% of the population who basically would have drawn, as I would have, a line across employed. And even groups like people with a BA, while they're much more likely, have significance. This is the people who were both unemployed at the second wave and had 12 months of unemployment since 2007. The way this is done, some people could have had 12 months unemployed since January 07, but were employed in 2001, and that's why that previous figure had more unemployment. I'm happy to take questions. Everybody's so quiet. Yeah, Anne.
Did you guys collect anything on the income changes for these long-term unemployed people? I haven't actually seen anything reported on.
We have detailed information. I have something coming up on transfer receipt.
Yeah.
And part of this is, as you can imagine, cleaning these data sets is very complicated. Yeah. And so we rushed out. There's a few analytics in here, but mostly descriptive. But we do know. Mm-hmm. So there's a paper on the people who were below the poverty line, the extent to which they got public and private transfers, and we have the extent to which people get UI. I'll get to some of that. So we have all of that. What we don't have, in retrospect, I'm not sure we could have figured out how to do it. We don't really have good data on consumption. So, people would say things like, the reason I avoided foreclosure is because I spent down my kids' I'd been saving for my kids' education, and I spent that down, and we avoided foreclosure. And we will observe a decline in assets, but the way we have the assets is we can't determine whether the decline in assets was due to their having lost value in the stock market or having spent down. The only thing we explicitly have, and we'll have a paper on this, are people who withdrew from their retirement accounts. We explicitly asked, did you stop putting in, did you take out? And there, again, this is the likelihood of various dimensions of inequality continuing. In 2009, with the Dow at 6,000, certainly everybody I knew was making jokes about 401ks being 201ks. But by 2011, there's increased inequality in assets because people who were laid off cashed out at the bottom to maintain consumption. So there was big inequality in assets in 2009, and it's increased by 2011 because if you're a faculty member and every month you're working, the TAA contributions are going in, and then the market goes back up, no faculty are making jokes about 201Ks because it's probably, what, 385Ks now, that maybe 15% lower than it was, whatever. But and so in the PSID data, which I don't have here, but we've looked at the PSID wealth data, the Gini coefficient of wealth inequality has continued to grow over this period. And I think the long run implications might be that you would really expect that to grow even faster than income inequality, because people more quickly, you know, if as the unemployment rate falls to 6%, the earnings inequality will begin to fall much more rapidly than the wealth inequality. So we do have that, but I don't have a lot of that here. I'm going to skip over this, but just I want to remember what the financial problems we have are: being behind on utility bills, recently using a payday loan, recently having a credit card canceled, and recently going through bankruptcy. So these are not minor financial problems. The housing problems, behind on rent, behind on mortgage, move for cost, move in with others to share expenses, evicted recently, and experienced homeless recently, and these usually mean in the last 12 months. And this may be hard to see, but again, what struck me is, so 32% of a random sample had one of these housing problems, which are pretty severe. 10% had them in both years. Food insecurity, I kept saying, are we sure this is right? It just seemed too high for me. But everybody says they've benchmarked it with the CPS. This is not hunger, this is, which is much smaller. But, you know, roughly 30% show up as food insecure in this USDA measure. And this is, did you not go to a doctor or a dentist because you couldn't afford to do so? You know, and that's a quarter of the people in the two surveys. So these are, you know, pretty extensive levels of hardship. This gets a little close to what Ann was talking about, because we have looked at detailed benefits. I guess the conventional wisdom about the safety net, the good news here is most people who are below 200% of the federal poverty line are getting at least some benefits. Private charity is really trivial, in part because the charities begin to suffer at the same time that need increases. I mean, as an example, when I say people laid off through no fault of their own, I had a niece working in New York at the Lower East Side Museum. 90% of their donors, who usually made annual contributions at the end of the year, had their money with Bernard Madoff. Needless to say, most of the staff there were laid off. I mean, and so that's the extreme example of why the recession response to charity is going to be as low. But again, I think there's always this, oh, it would be much better if people didn't have to pay taxes and were able to give money through private charity. But the benefit, at least the self-reported receipt of food or shelter assistance, as you'll see, is quite low. So, yeah.
It's hard to tell from this study, though, to what extent this is about the problems of Detroit, the Detroit area as a mature manufacturing center. At what extent a lot of these problems people would have even before the recession came. So do you have any idea about how you would establish some kind of baseline?
Yeah, and that's and so basically what we're starting to do is to look at things like people who had no unemployment spell prior to wave one, what kinds of changes. So we're literally, this is data that a bunch of people rushed to get some descriptive papers ready for the APAM meeting, which was earlier in November. So that's exactly right. But we do have people who had no recent history of unemployment, getting laid off, and what happens to them. And then we also have people coming back. So at this point, this is very descriptive, and I'm not making any causal statement. You would expect the changes to be bigger in this area because the hits were better. But in a small sample, that actually makes it better, because if you couldn't do a study like this in an area that went from, I don't know, 4 to 8% unemployment, you just wouldn't have as many people. And again, you can see that this is not the Detroit City, but the Detroit metro area, but the percentage of the population with incomes below twice the poverty line is quite substantial, about a third. And these are the transfer receipts. TANF welfare reform basically ended the cyclical sensitivity to TANF, so not many people get those. SNAP is food stamps. Again, we were talking about this earlier. A lot of low-income people don't qualify for UI benefits, but 70% of the population got at least one of the program benefits, and a substantial number got more than one benefit. And then the private charity numbers are obviously much lower, which is what I was mentioning before. I think these are hard to see, but this is just a simple descriptive regression. African Americans, households with more children, less educated, the long-term unemployed, people with health limitations, those below the poverty line, and those living in high census tract areas are more likely to use public benefits. This is a sample, which is just people, you're either below the poverty line or below 200% of the poverty line. Again, the safety net is very uneven, so the probability of getting no benefits is 60% if you're a non-black household without children, not this meaning being 100 to 200% of the poverty line, with more than a high school degree, who were not laid off and didn't have health limitations. So 60% have none. But if you're a black family with children in poverty, less than high school, so the disadvantage, your probability of getting no transfers is 3%, and your probability of getting three or more benefits is 20%. And one of the reasons poverty didn't go up as much as I thought it would have gone up is because particularly the expansion of food stamps and the earned income tax credit. These are the predicted charity use, and again, the numbers are quite small relative to the public benefits. Let me quickly go through this. This is, there's one interesting punchline here. We ask people a lot about job search. There is a substantial amount of job search, both for among people who were not working at the interview. So basically, half of the people not working were looking for a job, but there's also a substantial amount of people who were working looking. These folks put in more applications. In some sense, this is a little harder because you have to put in applications to keep your UI. So in some sense, these are more interesting, that people who are working are over time more likely, just as likely to be employed. You can see of the people working at wave one, 68% had the same employer, 18% had a new employer, and 13% were unemployed. So in terms of trying to do some changes over time, we think we've got the sample to do that. basically I want to go to, I'll just go to here. It turns out that the probability of finding a new job is, if you're looking, is much higher among those people who are employed. It's probably not surprising if you're an employer and you're getting applications from people who are employed and people who are unemployed. One, it can be, I mean, we haven't done, this is really just simple. We haven't done anything other than correct for individual attributes, but the employer might say, well, this person is a better prospect. But so, again, in terms of inequality, what it looks like is the ability to get a new job is much greater among the people who are more advantaged than among the people who are disadvantaged. So new hiring from in the area tends to go to people who are unemployed, who are employed, and among the unemployed to people who have shorter unemployment spells. So that brings me to the Stimulus Act and why I was optimistic and why I'm so pessimistic. Now, and again, I think there's been a good deal of research on this, so I don't think these things are necessarily controversial. The stimulus was successful, but too small in hindsight. It was terribly explained by the administration. I think just about every time one sees something in the media, it's the failed stimulus. And in some sense, the stimulus, in my view, has fed this deficit mania, which now is likely to lead to further cuts in safety net programs that I think are important. So the kinds of stimulus expansions, and again, people are familiar with this, a massive expansion of unemployment insurance benefits to 99 weeks, and then the 99 weeks has just withered away. Nobody even talks about it. A number of states have already responded to the recession by cutting the number of weeks of unemployment. So in Michigan, which obviously paid out a lot of unemployment benefits over the last 5 or 6 years, the governor and the legislature, which turned Republican in 2010, said, well, the only way to deal with the long-run stability of the unemployment insurance system would either be to raise the UI tax on firms or reduce benefits. And so they reduced benefits. So Michigan has gone from a 26-week spell of unemployment to a 20-week spell. And I think Florida has done the same. So rather than seeing the kind of unemployment insurance expansion we saw in the stimulus, I think future recessions are likely to find us with shorter unemployment. Big increase in food stamp benefits, which in my view went a long way to offsetting what would have been even bigger increases in food insecurity and poverty when they're counted in poverty. Was a flashpoint in the campaign about gifts to get votes. There was this TANF emergency jobs program, again, not much discussed, but it's interesting. Just last week, the president has proposed a wage subsidy for firms that hire. The TANF emergency jobs program basically provided states with funds that could be used to subsidize public or private sector jobs. Was the first time we had done anything like that since the CETA program was ended in 1980. Not much rigorous research on it, but certainly it seems somewhat promising. Taxes this was part of the tax cut, expanded EITC and expanded per child credit. And the EITC and the per child credit relative to the pre-stimulus tax system provides something like $2,500 extra a year to minimum wage families, families earning around $3,000. So these were large cash increases, and those are likely to go away. And when people talk about extending the Bush tax cuts, they're not talking about extending these, which were specifically targeted on low-income families with kids. The human capital expansions, more money for Head Start and Early Head Start, a big Pell Grant expansion. In fact, we're doing some work with community colleges in the Detroit area, and one of the college presidents showed us the sources of funds of the college, and they get a certain tax rate in the property tax base in the county times property value, and the rate was constant and property values went down by about 30%, and that reduction in revenue was almost totally offset by the increase in Pell Grant expansion. And again, people have talked about, well, we need to roll back the Pell Grant expansion. There was a proposal that they would be indexed to inflation and kept at the current level. The most interesting article that I've read about the stimulus is the one by Bob Hall in a journal called Daedalus. It's written at a very a layperson can read it. But basically, if you read Bob Hall's analysis, he sounds very much like Paul Krugman in saying that the stimulus was too small. The combination of increased federal purchases and benefits raised output and income. Stimulus worked in the sense that the recession would have been substantially worse without the stimulus. And then he goes on to say basically it's because it took the stimulus to offset federal and state budget cuts. And what happened after the stimulus expired? The stimulus expired and the states kept, I don't need to tell people in California, cutting budgets and employment. So this notion that the stimulus was a failure, it's just a simple counterfactual problem. Yes, poverty is higher than it was, but poverty would have been even higher. Unemployment is higher than 6%, but it would have been even higher. You know, this has been a pretty dreadful period. The unemployment rate in September meant that we had roughly 4 years, 3.5 years with the unemployment rate above 15%. And as I mentioned, the Brookings projections suggest that unemployment isn't going to get to 5 or 6% for quite a while. Yeah.
Just that point about the example of the community college cuts, and that have you seen any work that tries to sort of really quantify the substitution of the federal stimulus and other money for state? Because you hear these stories like, well, all the federal thing did was fill in all the cuts at the state level. But I just wonder if there's any sort of real account.
Yeah, I don't. In the Bob Hall paper, he sort of got some simple. No, but that's a very simple macro estimate where he does that. But I haven't seen a specific analysis. And I guess one, you know, and then people say, well, the problem with Pell Grants is it just leads colleges to raise tuition. I haven't seen a good analysis of the extent to which that happens. I guess one, there is variation because property values change dramatically differently in different places.
Right.
And the Pell Grant increase was the same. And so one could see the extent. I mean, basically, he was saying we were able to stay afloat because this is now our new source of revenue. It comes with it does lead to behavioral changes on both sides. So it turns out that as part of our study, Kristen Seefeld has been doing a qualitative panel, and she's been following some low-income women for 5 or 6 years now. It's sort of Eden and Lane making ends meet today, but she's following people over a long period. And she has heard that people use Pell Grants as a new way to get resources. And so if I register, I get a lump sum payment of $2,000. Mm-hmm. It turns out that the colleges, though, and I don't think these, it's sort of like error rates in food stamps, I don't think they've moved against anybody. If I give you $2,000 when you enroll in September, and if you've dropped out by October 15th, I'm on the hook for getting the money. So in fact, MDRC is trying to is actually doing a demonstration where they call it aid like a paycheck, where they're distributing this money over the period. The idea is both, if I give you the lump sum and you go home and your family knows that you now have $2,000, of which the tuition was only $800 at the community college, yeah, they may say you should pay the rent this month, and then by the end of the term you have no money, so you drop out to get a job that if they distribute it to you on a regular basis, it will, and sort of paternalism, it will help you stay in school. The incentive will be that, you know, as long as I keep in school, I'll get the whole money. But so they're doing this kind of demonstration. But we have heard that on that end, there are people who are realizing this is a way to get some income, is to go, and you can only do it once.
Right.
Because if you've dropped out, then you show up the next semester, they'll say, wait a minute, you took the Pell Grant and you dropped out, you owe us back. So, but at least our sample of community colleges we've dealt with so far are three, and we certainly haven't had any president who said, oh yeah, we raised tuition because we knew that, I mean, he basically was saying the Pell Grants kept us from having to massively close down programs that we otherwise would have closed down. I mean, I think there are a lot of, what it's saying is there are a lot of natural experiments that are going on, of which there are lots of opportunities for research. So, you know, California's budget cutting certainly was different than North Dakota's, where there was an oil boom. And so what can one make of what happened to community college enrollment in various places, or any of the areas with stimulus money? But some stimulus money was designed just to be pure substitution. I mean, some of it was just, here it is, don't lay off teachers. Then it went away, and you laid off teachers. So it's, in that sense, it's hard to say the stimulus was a failure, because you can see, okay, we had stimulus, teachers didn't lay off, we took away stimulus, they went away. But the political argument was, oh, we had all this stimulus, and the unemployment rate is still high, so obviously the stimulus failed. So I've mentioned this. So the fact that the poverty rate this cycle doesn't look any different than this cycle or this cycle, in some ways that's remarkable given how much deeper this recession was. It's the poverty rate for all persons and for adults. It also doesn't, and I think I have Bell Sawhill's projection one or two ahead, it also doesn't give you much expectation that we're going to get a big decline in poverty going forward, given the budget cuts that I expect are going to come in a lot of the programs that I've been talking about.
So Sheldon,
yeah,
you may be coming to this, and so just put me off, but all these different programs that were either expanded or lengthened or whatever, and the fact that they're now likely to disappear, and that we are living in these tough economic times. If you were going to make a recommendation about one or two to keep, which ones would you?
Sure, I'm happy to jump. I mean, I think that.
Sort of, are you going to get there?
Yeah, but I mean, obvious, because I just talked about it, the ones in the stimulus which are the simplest to keep are the child tax credit, mm-hmm. the per capita child credit. So, as part of the Bush tax cuts, everybody with a kid under 18, except for very high incomes, gets $1,000 per child. But it's not refundable, and except then at one point, I think you had to earn at least $12,000 a year. If you earned $12,000 a year, then it was partially refundable, and the Stimulus Act lowered that to $3,000. So anybody who earns at least $3,000 can benefit from this, and I think that makes it refundable. I mean, I've the numbers are in the Center on Budget and Policy, and that's why somebody with three kids. So when we go back to keeping the Bush tax credits for everybody below $250,000, we go back to the rules on the Bush per capita child credit. We go back to the Bush EITC. So those things, I think, immediately go away. And, you know, it's going to be hard enough. I mean, I actually hope all the Bush tax cuts expire, and that then they would do something more sensible than just continue them for everybody up to $250,000. An example being, I would rather use some of the revenue at the bottom on this than what you're likely to get. So those are simple ones. And then obviously the other ones are a lot of the early childhood expansions. You know, we never got the contrast would be between under Tony Blair, they went from basically no Head Start program to virtually universal coverage of poor kids within five or so years. You know, we've never had an increase as large as that. So there would be a number of those that were, I mean, when I was thinking about it in 2009, I thought, oh, the unemployment insurance modernization, you know, which made it easier for part-time workers to get part-time unemployment. There were a bunch of things that the stimulus made states do with regard to UI to get stimulus money. Well, already the states are going in the other direction because they owe all this money to the UI trust fund. So I think I've already said this. This is why I'm depressed about the prospects of reducing poverty. Real wage growth for less educated workers is unlikely. You know, this notion that if we unleash the power of firms by cutting tax rates, we're going to get all this employment increase. In fact, there are these stories. There was just one in the New York Times about the skills gap. I think it was in the Sunday Times, where somebody was saying, if there's this skill gap, why won't employers provide on-the-job training? So employers would like to hire workers who are fully skilled to work on the machines they have in their factories for relatively low wages, and they don't want to spend the money training, and I just don't see much likely growth for less educated workers without policy changes that are not very likely. And I think I've mentioned most of these others before we've gotten here, these were Bell Sawhill's projections. You know, she gets us a rapid decline in poverty to 14.5%. by 2016, and these were done before one does what projections. Now, this is the official poverty rate, so food stamps and the EITC cuts wouldn't show up in this. With cuts like that likely, I don't think there's great prospects. And basically it sort of goes back to the where I started, where people during the war on poverty era, I've been doing a lot of reading for this project with Martha Bailey, just in what not just economists but the popular press was saying about the ability of government to do these programs. And Peter's probably the only one in this room who can remember back. There was it Nelson at Yale who wrote this book called The Moon in the Ghetto? It was this optimism about it, basically. This was a serious economist writing, basically, if we have the technical ability, we've put a man on the moon, and so social science can do all of these things to help us reshape public policy so we can get rid of poverty. Jim Tobin had a piece in, I think it was the New Republic in the early 70s, called something, It Can Be Done, Eliminating Poverty by 1976 for the bicentennial. Bob Lampman had a piece projecting that poverty, the way we measure it, would be zero by the early 1980s. It was Lampman's defense of an absolute poverty line. This was a book he wrote in 71 called Ends and Means of Reducing Income Poverty. And he was basically against a relative measure. He said, you ought to set out an absolute measure, and it's eminently doable. We have an absolute measure. We put it into place in the late 60s, and by 1980, we should have achieved it. And then the next generation can come up with what it thinks the poverty line ought to be at that time. So, these were not crackpots writing about being optimistic about the ability of government programs to effectively reduce poverty. And today, in some sense, the expectation is government can't do anything, so spending money on reducing poverty is a waste of time. The same thing, it's going on in this discussion. Will the economy tank if the tax rates on high income people goes to 39% from 35%? And again, this long argument in the poverty literature about the poor being irresponsible. Gordon Berlin was just having some correspondence with Larry Mead, who's one of the people who believes that jobs are available if only you'll search. In our Detroit study, it turns out that unemployed blacks search more than unemployed whites, but they find jobs less than unemployed whites. I guess Larry would say they're just telling you they search. They're not really searching as hard, but certainly from the information they tell us, the survey, the regressions that I skipped through basically showed that it's harder to find a job if you're long-term unemployed than if you're not, and blacks are more likely to be long-term unemployed, so if they're searching the same, they'll be less likely to get a job because of being long-term unemployed, or because employers are less likely to hire blacks, not because they're searching less, because they're actually searching slightly more. So, in some sense, all of these are very hard sells in the current context. These were some of my favorites. I was talking to Peter. I do not understand why we didn't have a massive subsidized jobs program in the summer of 2009 for youth. The youth unemployment rate was more than 20% in most cities. A summer youth jobs program is not very expensive. I think that was a missed opportunity. Given the high unemployment rates, given the difficulty of people, and I haven't even raised the issue of people who have criminal records. I was just going to say the likelihood that people who are high school graduates or less who are long-term unemployed have a very hard time finding jobs, even if they search, makes the logic of having low-wage subsidized jobs of last resort a very reasonable policy for a period in which everybody is projecting 3 or 4 more years of very high unemployment rates. This last bullet, and it's funny because you know, even the Obama administration doesn't want to talk about this. I gave a similar talk like this to some people on the Domestic Policy Council at the White House this spring, and somebody basically said to me, "Oh, before I saw that last slide, we were going to invite you to talk to some Senate Finance Committee hearings that we were having, but now we can't." You know, the Democrats get to invite 2 people, and the Republicans get to invite 2 people, but that's considered hostile to the administration's policy. But basically, there's not enough. You know, where we are, where we are going is better than extending the Bush tax cuts forever, but given the extent of poverty and inequality, it's, you know, we're basically we're going to be doing less harm than we otherwise would have done. Again, in all of this, so the Democrats say, "Oh, you can't touch Social Security or Medicare." Well, why can't, you know, this is sort of the Republican version, why don't you tax the subsidy value of Medicare Part D, which people could estimate what that is, or why couldn't you have Medicare premiums that are income tested? So if you're going to say you can't put Medicare cuts on the table, then the things that are likely to be on table are, okay, let's freeze Pell Grants, let's let the food stamp expansions, which I'm not sure when they expire, but there was a 14% benefit increase in April 2009, so at some point that food stamp benefit levels will go down 14% under current rule. It's sort of the same thing like the Social Security, whatever it was for this year, the Social Security tax rebate is going to expire. So all of the things that are likely to expire are the parts of the stimulus package that kept poverty from being even higher during the stimulus. So that's not why I'm not very optimistic. So. Yeah.
Sort of comment question. The only real public official that I hear saying government can do something is John Stewart. And I just saw that the Census Bureau released some data that includes supplemental poverty measure in order to make this, that helps make the statement that, you know, the earned income credit helps. Is that getting any serious play anywhere?
No. So in fact, on the supplemental measure, poverty went up less than it did in the official measure because they count the food stamp expansion. So, you know, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities has great reports on these things, which sometimes get picked up for a day in the New York Times or not. But, you know, you have to admit the Obama administration doesn't want to talk about poverty. I mean, from the very beginning, Biden had a commission on the struggling middle class or something, I forget what it was called, and they stopped talking about that. I mean, I teach undergraduates, and so to keep the course current, I had some links, I think. So when I taught it in maybe 2008, was the I had these links to the White House, or maybe to the Obama campaign webpage, and they had one of their policies was to raise the minimum wage to $9 by 2011, and they had all these policies. And then by the time I taught the course the next year, all the web pages were down. I mean, they were still talking about Pell Grants and food stamps expansion, but all the other... So I think the bottom line is that, you know, what's funny is that, you know, Paul Krugman and Joe Stiglitz are considered crazy leftists by a lot of people. So... you know, certainly in so Krugman has been writing about this intensively from the time he started working at the Times, and but you know, the notion to me that people think, oh well, Krugman's just a left wing nut like Bill O'Reilly's a right wing nut is sort of, but that's sort of the state of play of this. So as I said, you'd sort of have to. You know, when you go back and read the discourse from the 60s, and again, it's remarkable. I went to the Nixon Library because my daughter's getting a PhD in history, so it's actually the first time I've done any archival research, and she wanted, so I thought I'd go along. And so I read Moynihan's papers around the Family Support Act of... but I think it was first proposed in 69?
Yeah, but he didn't.
Okay, in 72. And there are these memos. Martin Anderson, who was against the Family Assistance Plan, worked for Arthur Burns, who was at the Council of Economic Advisor. And there are these memos that are being sent to the White House, addressed to Nixon, Haldeman, and Ehrlichman, in which it's like a graduate seminar. So Moynihan is saying, Martin Anderson is saying, you don't want to do the Family Assistance Plan because it would extend welfare to the working poor. Now that's exactly what proponents of the negative income tax wanted to do. And he's quoting, I forget, Polanyi. Right, so he's sending this, and then Moynihan writes back a memo and said, no, that's right, there's this article in the journal, I don't know, remember which journal, by Mark Blaug, an economic historian, and he says that analysis is wrong. And so I'm reading these memos, and it's like what you would have gotten in a graduate, and this is going to the White House, and I just, the notion that people were having intellectual discourse about policy. I doubt Nixon read them, but they were being sent to Haldeman and Ehrlichman. And when I was at the Nixon Library, the archivists were telling me that there are a bunch of Nixon loyalists who still believe he was driven out of office by a cabal by the Kennedys. But one of the things they say is, if you hadn't driven him out, we would have gotten national health insurance, because Nixon did have a national health insurance proposal, which again looks more just like the Family Assistance Plan was more liberal than any welfare reform plan since. So was his national. So it was just, it's a remarkable, so that's part of, because I've been doing all this reading for this book on the history of the war on poverty, you know, I'm reading all this stuff about optimism, about being able to reduce poverty and government being able to, you know, we can reduce labor supply disincentives by doing this and that versus the discourse today.
I'd like to see you get your chart about rising votes published in addition to
your... Yeah, it's hard to, you know, this gets well beyond any area of expertise, but I really do think that we have this ingrained view that if you're unemployed, it's your fault. If you're poor, it's your fault. And I actually thought that what looked to me like it wasn't mass unemployment on the scale of the Great Recession, but certainly you can imagine in the Detroit area, it looked like mass unemployment would change people's attitudes about unemployment. And yet nothing, there's been no discussion of unemployment insurance other than we gave out benefits for too long a period, and now that we owe this money back to the Labor Department, we've got to cut.
Does your Detroit study ask people anything about their perceptions about...
We haven't. Maybe we should do, you know, the way these surveys get operated is that the person who does research on assets says, I've got an hour of assets questions for you, and the person who does research on mental health says, I have an hour of mental health questions, and then we sit.
Look at the general social surveys.
I don't know. That would be the place probably to look to see if there are these changes, whether it led to any.
Do you remember this paper by Erza Luttner 10 years ago, which sort of suggested that people were more likely to support public assistance programs if the people who were getting public assistance in their sort of local area looked more like them? It'd be interesting.
And he did something on Katrina as well, right? Because there was this...
I think that's right, but I haven't...
So my armchair expectation is, do you think there was less charity sent to New York than to Katrina because people don't like New Yorkers? I mean, there's pretty big devastation in New York. It's the discussion has withered away pretty quickly. So, I don't know, maybe there's a natural experiment study to do in a couple of years on charitable giving. Peter?
You didn't talk about this in your presentation, but initially on the domains you guys looked at, parenting was one of the domains you looked at, and this was, I was wondering how you found the obsession.
So Ariel Khalil, who was here, right, last year, is the person who put the parenting and child outcome questions on, and she has a paper in progress, and as I remember... she finds some effect of long-term unemployment on child internalizing and externalizing behavior. So I commented on the draft, but there were five or six drafts that I commented on last month. But they'll all be posted as working papers within the next 6 weeks or so. So as I said, we had this rush to get at least the descriptive on the National Poverty Center website out.
In the political back and forth, concern over poverty, youth allies, think of the way in which these issues had a chance of coming up in the elections of 2008 and of 2012. In 2008, Obama did spend some of his time talking about human investments, which for our subprofession leads into these cascading rates of returns. The younger, the higher the social rate of return. The poorer, the higher the social rate of return. It's neat, you know. Poverty and growth are, conflated well. That was 2008. 2012, I was cavorting with some of the progressive meetings, and it was these conferences on what to do for the middle class. Poor? Did you ever hear about the poor in 2012?
Yeah, in fact, not to be cynical, but Obama gave a very nice speech on poverty in the campaign while John Edwards was still in the race, which got reprinted in the Stanford Center's Pathways magazine. So you can go back and find it. And it very much, you know, he was channeling Robert Kennedy, how can we live in a rich country and let poor kids... be as far behind as they are. And so it's perfectly consistent. So when I was optimistic, I don't have it in anymore, but I would say, okay, look, here's this quote from candidate Obama, and then the first thing that happens a month after the office, there's this big increase in early Head Start and Head Start. What I'm told is, how did all this stuff get in the stimulus bill? You know, there was some notion that there were going to be X% was going to go to tax cuts, And then Arlen Specter said, "Y percent has to go to NIH or I won't vote for it." So our university got a lot because of Arlen Specter. ISR is getting a new wing with stimulus money, and the ground was just broken. I don't want to ask, but I thought you had to be shovel ready. But that was stimulus money. And so much with social programs, and I'm told they actually asked Bob Green, you know, when I said, oh, there are all these things poverty researchers wanted, that Bob Greenstein was asked to send a memo of what are your top priorities, and they just went down the list until they spent the money that they had allocated to those things. So it's not necessary, and Jared Bernstein, who came from EPI, was Biden's chief economist. And then the other part that, you know, Larry Summers didn't want public jobs in there, so that didn't get in there. And that's how they were doing it so quickly. I mean, the stimulus was passed, I think, in February, within a month of getting in office. So I probably was naive, overly optimistic when I was in my, this is the best of times, this is the worst of times mode. But yeah, it's totally off the table. And a reporter this time.
The policies that are off the table are marginalized or pro health and pro growth.
Yeah.
We care about that for other reasons.
Yeah.
Number one, but that's all we do.
It is 1:30. I'm going to suggest that we formally end Sheldon's talk by thanking him and that people who would like to continue asking questions.
Thank you.
Wait. What's your reading? What's going to happen in January?